Constitution. That's how I felt about it. And when you, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, and both parties have done it, you're assassinating the Constitution.
I want to thank David Goodman, Ari Berman, Jerry Mitchell. Thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking tonight in Chicago at the Crown Plaza Hotel, Conference Center, Chicago O'Hare Airport area. Check our website at democracynow.org. And we have two job openings at Democracy Now! Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome back to Renee Feltz.
O'clock p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The Thursday evening news is next.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Good in the Hood, a multicultural music and food festival held in North and Northeast Portland, June 27th, 28th, and 29th. The festival features a variety of cultural food vendors, an information village, a kids' space area, and an ethnic marketplace, as well as a parade and live entertainment provided by Gino Michaels and Soul City, Sonny Hess, Kimberly Monique, the 503 Steppers, Sistas for Life, and more. Again, that's Good in the Hood, June 27th, 28th, and 29th at Lillis Albina Park, North Russell Street at Flint Avenue. More information about Good in the Hood can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from B Space Movement and Expressive Art Studio, hosting the Life Art Being Integrative Arts Festival, a week of practicing presence with the self, the body, and earth. July 7th through 12th at B-Space and Portland, Shambhala Center. Life Art Being includes authentic movement, Shambhala art, deep ecology practices, and more. Information at b-space.org/lifeartbeing.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland police come under fire for not releasing data on the use of force against transients.
The Canadian Supreme Court has restored a Native Nation's claim to their land.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill that would expand oil drilling in the United States. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 26, 2014. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Robert Barncord. A new report from the Portland Mercury found that Portland police have removed the transient category from their use of force reports. This means that at a time when use of force incidents against homeless people have been increasing, the police are seemingly no longer releasing data on these incidents. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Dennis Theralt of the Portland Mercury, who's been following the data released by the Portland Police.
I wonder if you can start by just talking about what you've recently discovered about the way that the Portland Police are reporting the use of force against transients in the region.
So, what I've learned is that they have stopped publicly reporting use of force incidents against folks they labeled as transient. And they stopped that as of the first 3 months of this year. It's because they claim the category is too vague, if that makes sense.
And prior to this stopping of using this category, what was the trend?
Well, the trend had showed a slight surge, actually, and it was something that they had flagged. They've been reporting every quarter, every 3 months, use of force overall, broken out in a lot of different ways. It's because of the federal police reform case. And they had reported after the summer of 2013, they said, we've noticed an uptick. That we went from 76 in the first 3 months of 2013, that's transient and folks with mental health issues, to 93 the 3 months after that, and then 112 in the third quarter of 2013. And it went back down to 93 in the fourth quarter. So they said, we need to look at this. And turns out, as part of their look, they stopped reporting it because they thought the numbers weren't getting them to a place where they could identify chronically homeless, unsheltered people, which is what they were mostly interested in.
Well, and interestingly, there was a use of force incident just a couple of weeks ago in which police shot and killed a man who was wielding a crowbar, who I guess would fit into that category?
He would fit in that category. That absolutely would. And actually, that would be one where they would be able to say this is someone who was unsheltered. And is sort of would be defined in the government's parlance as chronically homeless. And how many other folks like that are there? You know, and presumably this is a deadly force case, but there are many other ways to use force besides using a gun. So you know, we should be able to keep tracking this. There was 76 people, like I said, at the beginning of a year ago at this time. That went up to 93 and 112 at various times. And, you know, if the number is going up, we should be able to get to a reason why, hopefully.
Does the fact that the police have removed this category have anything to do with the way that they're reporting for the Department of Justice settlement with the court?
Well, the fact that they were reporting it in the first place is because of that settlement, and they claimed, you know, they said, look, we want to make sure that the data we're putting out allows people to draw meaningful conclusions, and they say that the struggle they're having, one, they have a new person who's putting the reports together, but they also say that it's difficult to get granular data from police reports right now. They're rolling out a new record system which will allow police reports to, you know, when an officer's writing a report, they'll actually be able to fill out more boxes, which then can be entered into a system and put in a database, and that's happened slower than they've hoped, and so I think they actually want to put out the data because I think in their mind they think that being transparent with the data will help their cause. And they have admitted in this case that they made a mistake by not explaining why they took that category out. It looked a lot worse than it is, and it led people, I think, into some sinister prognostications. I think the issue that we have to look at, though, is it's great that the police bureau is making changes. It says it's being proactive. But we don't have anyone outside of the city infrastructure right now who is on the ground assessing these policy changes, looking at reports, talking to people, and evaluating, you know, are these changes actually working and how can they work better? That's not going to happen until we get a monitor in place, and we're months behind. We don't even have the settlement agreement laying out the reforms formally approved yet. It's been almost 2 years at this point since they came to town.
And that compliance officer, when they are hired, will they be independent and outside of the city's infrastructure?
They will be. They're going to get their money from the police bureau, so it will look like on paper that they are attached to the police bureau, but that was a decision, that was an arbitrary decision in some way. They had to put a budget item somewhere. They could have put it in any other office. I think they tried putting it in the Office of Equity and Human Rights at one point. That was a non-starter. That person will not work for the city. They will be independent. They will answer to the city council. They will answer to the federal government. But they're not there yet, so we don't have that person. But when we get them, they will be independent.
Well, thanks so much. Again, I've been speaking with Dennis Theriault with the Portland Mercury. His most recent article in the Hall Monitor blog, A Lesson on Transparency, is on portlandmercury.com. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Two jam-packed town hall meetings on the proposed Portland street fee this week have already had an impact on City Hall. Mayor Charlie Hales and Commissioner Steve Novick today announced they're shifting their position on how to make sure the proposed street fee will not be wasted. Hales and Novick had said they would create a charter amendment to lock in spending for the proposed fee on maintenance and safety only, ensuring it could not be spent on pet projects. But today they pulled the charter amendment off the table because Hales says it's too confusing. The two have outraged many by pushing forward an across-the-board charge for all city residents to pay for street maintenance and improvements. At public meetings Tuesday and Wednesday, Hales and Novick got an earful of public opposition to the plan. Hales says the city needs more than $75 million per year to take care of street maintenance. A spokesman said today the two are committed to ensuring revenue from any new funding mechanism would be dedicated to improving the maintenance and safety of the transportation network, including paving and sidewalks. But now, no charter amendment will be heading to voters to nail down that commitment. The spokesman said work groups will start this summer to figure out how to enact the residential and business street fees. Hales and Novick expect a council vote on the transportation fee by this fall. It's expected to be enacted by July 2015.
The 4th of July is coming next week, but if you plan to go fishing in the Rogue River and Siskiyou area, you might plan on throwing back your catch. The Oregon Health Authority today advised anglers to limit consumption of some species of fish in the Applegate Lake. Health officials issued a fish consumption advisory on certain species from Applegate Lake because of elevated levels of mercury found in fish that had been caught there. Applegate Lake is located in the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, about 30 miles southwest of Medford. Mercury can build up in resident fish, such as bass, bluegill, yellow perch, crappie, catfish, and suckers, because these fish live in one place their entire life and are therefore exposed to cumulative contaminants over their entire life cycle. The officials say that hatchery-raised trout and salmon less than 12 inches in length are considered a safe choice, at least until the advisory is lifted.
Hillsborough Parks and Recreation Department staff have closed the trails at Jackson Bottom Wetlands Preserve following a second reported cougar sighting this morning. City of Hillsborough employees are investigating the reported sighting and have asked the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife for help. At approximately 8:30 a.m., Hillsborough Parks and Recreation staff received a phone call alerting employees to a sighting on the north side of the preserve, adjacent to a residential neighborhood. A homeowner reported seeing a cougar from inside her home, then observed the animal leave on its own. She described seeing the animal in a tree, roughly the size of her golden retriever it was, with a long tail. The homeowner did not report any aggressive behavior. On Monday, Parks and Recreation staff received its first phone call from a trail user who reported seeing a cougar on the east side of the preserve. Staff made the decision on Monday to close the trails in order to investigate the reported sighting, but did not find any sign of the cougar.
The Cascade AIDS Project will mark National HIV Testing Day tomorrow, Friday, June 27th, by offering free rapid HIV testing throughout the day at Pivot, which is located at 209 Southwest 4th Avenue in downtown Portland. Rapid HIV testing is simple and provides results in about 20 minutes from a small drop of blood taken from a finger. Both confidential and anonymous, this testing is available, and the testing will be on a first-come, first-served basis. It will happen from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. tomorrow. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends that everyone aged 15 to 65 should be screened for HIV infection. Testing is also recommended at least annually for individuals at increased risk, gay and bisexual men, people who inject drugs, and/or people with multiple sex partners. Statistics from the National Institutes of Health show that HIV-positive individuals who know their status and are on effective drug treatment can reduce their risk of transmitting HIV by 96%. Additionally, as part of the Update Your Status campaign, people can go to the website to reserve an appointment. That website is www.testingforall. That's T-E-S-T-I-N-G, the number 4, A-L-L dot org.
And in national news, the House passed a bill today to expand oil drilling in the United States. If enacted, it would expedite oil and gas leasing on federal lands, open new offshore drilling areas, and expand drilling in Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Friends of the Earth climate and energy campaigner Lucas Ross, who says this bill is everything big oil wants for Christmas.
Lucas, I wonder if you could start by telling us what you think is the significance of the Lowering Gasoline Prices to Fuel an America That Works Act passed this morning by the U.S. House.
Well, fundamentally, it's based on a flawed premise. It's saying, basically, that if we expand our domestic oil production, we're going to be able to lower the price of a commodity that is set globally. There is no way that we extract it, even if we drill as aggressively as possible, there's still no way that we can make our economy immune from oil price shocks. House Republicans have advertised this very much in terms of expanding drilling offshore in the Alaska Petroleum Reserve and on federal lands onshore as well. They've advertised this in terms of energy security, but the only real path to energy security we can have is one that embraces renewables.
And what are the risks from this increase in drilling domestically of more oil spills and disasters like the Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico?
You know, yeah, it's obvious that we cannot drill for oil offshore safely, and that's one of the main things that this bill would do, open new areas for offshore drilling off the Atlantic coast and Virginia and off of the coast of California as well. It's clear that we can't do it safely and that accidents can have horrible effects on our economy. Just look at the Gulf Coast after Deepwater Horizon. But, I mean, if you want to talk about economic damages, we should talk about the economic damage that is going to be caused by taking more fossil reserves out of the ground, turning them into fuel, and combusting them. That's what's going to hurt our economy the most over the long term. And even if it were possible to somehow lower the price of gas by doing more drilling, I mean, there's still, like, it still pales in comparison to the amount of damage that's going to be inflicted on our economy in terms of superstorms, wildfires, crop losses, and everything we already know is associated with climate change.
And Lucas, can you tell us about the amendment that was introduced by Earl Blumenauer, our congressional representative from the Portland area, on this bill?
Yeah, so as you know, Earl Blumenauer is a champion on these environmental issues, and he sponsored an amendment that was unfortunately cut down by the GOP majority, but that was introduced nonetheless on ending royalty-free leases in the Gulf of Mexico. So basically, late 1990s, price of oil is much less than it is now. There was a feeling that we needed to incentivize offshore drilling, and part of that was a package of rules that allowed oil companies to get leases offshore that only had royalty charges attached to them if oil rose above a certain price. But some of those leases that were given away didn't have a price threshold and have been producing oil, and the companies that own them haven't been paying any royalties to we the people, the owners of those resources. And it is prohibitively expensive. It is one of the biggest giveaways to fossil fuel companies on the books. Already in 2013, it had cost us $11 billion in lost revenue, and over the next decade, it could be another $15.5 billion. So this is at a time of, you know, admitted budget constraints where we have tons of other priorities such as, you know, mounting income inequality and transitioning our economy off of fossil fuels. We have this money that we're giving away for free to some of the richest companies that have ever existed.
And so this is essentially a corporate giveaway for deepwater oil drilling that the U.S. government has kept in place?
Yeah, it's a loophole. It's proved incredibly difficult to fix, but, you know, good for Representative Blumenauer for bringing it back into the discussion. It needs to be talked about because, you know, it's something that if you explain very straightforwardly is, you know, it sounds crazy, and people wonder how this could have possibly happened.
Well, thanks so much. Again, Lucas Ross, climate and energy campaigner with Friends of the Earth. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The Canadian Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a Native nation on a long-contested issue of land rights. The court granted Aboriginal title to more than 1,700 square kilometers of land in British Columbia to the Tsilkot'in First Nation. This is the first time the court has made such a ruling regarding Aboriginal land. Grand Chief Stuart Phillip said that today's ruling is a win for all Canadians.
Why has go helped? Bisinak seal and chai as squeeze as suit I want to begin by acknowledging the Coast Salish peoples, the Tsleil-Waututh, the Squamish, and the Musqueam. And I want to begin my remarks by expressing on behalf of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, I want to thank the Tsleil-Waututh elders, their spiritual leaders, their chiefs, for the courageous leadership they've demonstrated for well over 100 years, and certainly for the last 25 years in carrying forward this historic legal challenge to the racist notions of the province of British Columbia and the government of Canada with respect to the notion that First Nations people in this country only have rights restricted to the postage stamp reserve land bases. And I am so happy that the Supreme Court ruling today has completely rejected the BC Court of Appeal decision that Aboriginal title is only restricted to small spots of intensive use on behalf of the Indigenous peoples whose territory is the subject of a title claim. I believe that we owe a debt of gratitude to those legions of Indigenous leaders over the last 100 years who suffered the indignities of the residential school, who suffered the indignities of racist legislation, and yet persevered and carried that vision and that dream forward that someday that this country would come of age, that this province would come of age and recognize Indigenous land rights and know and understand that the Indigenous people were here first, and that by virtue of that undeniable fact, we have every right to expect to enjoy the benefits of the rich resources within our territories. And I believe today is a win for all Canadians and all British Columbians, certainly for my grandchildren and everyone's grandchildren, because now we have the opportunity, we have a platform to build a genuine dialogue of reconciliation that has eluded us for so long.
That was Grand Chief Stuart Phillip with the Tsleil-Waututh First Nation in British Columbia, Canada. Today's Canadian Supreme Court decision resolves many important legal questions, such as how to determine Aboriginal title and whether provincial laws apply to those lands. It will apply wherever there are outstanding land claims by Native nations in Canada.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Ariel Deranger about the Tar Sands Healing Walk in Alberta, Canada. That's followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6, featuring interviews with Wainima Leonard, Princess of the Lakota Oyateki Club from the Oregon State Penitentiary, and Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, President of the Union of British Columbia Indian Chiefs. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a chance of rain, a high of 68 and a low of 57. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 33 counts per minute in North Portland, spiking up to 61. 28 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 29 CPM, and North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current radiation count of 35 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, in 1945, the United Nations Charter was signed in San Francisco. And in 1975, two FBI agents and a member of the American Indian Movement were killed in a shootout at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, resulting in the controversial murder conviction of Leonard Peltier. The quote of the day comes from Pearl S. Buck. "The truth is always exciting. Speak it then. Life is dull without it."
Well, here it is, 5:25, and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Amazing! Some people who've long enjoyed a lifestyle of old money elegance are suddenly trying to downscale their lives and show a bit more of the common touch. They're not corporate chieftains, but they do run multi-million dollar operations and consider themselves role models for the masses. They are the Catholic bishops of the United States. And it's that role model thing that has them a bit flummoxed. Many are living in grand residences with extensive staffs and personal servants, socializing with the wealthy and political elites, moralizing from elevated pulpits, and, well, generally living in a lofty manner. This has left many of them aloof from the common folk, the very flock they supposedly tend. For years, such privileges for the bishops were accepted as normal, even deserved. Then, last year, Francis happened. Like a hurricane, a new pontiff and a new ethic hit the Catholic hierarchy. Pope Francis lives a Spartan life and goes openly and gladly among the masses, while stressing simplicity and personal humility as the proper demeanor for the clergy. The Church's moral emphasis, Francis says, by word and deed, must be on service to the poor and disadvantaged, and the existence of economic inequality must be a top priority, addressed as a social evil. So we now have the phenomena of bishops scrambling to cut extravagances, allocating more resources to the down and out, focusing on economic justice, becoming more available to ordinary parishioners, and, well, appearing more like Francis. Actually, though, they're not aligning their lifestyles and work with the Pope, but with the life and teaching of Jesus, the founder of their church. This is Jim Hightower saying, "Wow, that's a most impressive conversion." So here's an idea. If Francis can have this effect on the elites of the church, what say we turn him loose on the hubris of Wall Street and the extravagances of the corporate elites?
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
A report released today questions the United States' reliance on drones in the war on terror, warning the controversial weapons may escalate and perpetuate conflicts rather than end them. The report by the Stimson Center does not, however, condemn drones outright. The report is probably most notable for its authors, including former Middle East military commanders and former senior officials with the Pentagon, CIA, and FBI, who served during the Obama administration. The involvement of these elite members of the defense and intelligence communities gives weight to long-standing criticisms of the drone program. It's part of an ongoing shift that has seen both President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry pledge to reduce drone attacks in Yemen and Pakistan. The Stimson Center report does not, however, challenge the legality of so-called targeted killings, a category that can include assassinations of known terrorists, as well as individuals who merely exhibit behavior patterns that may lead to terrorism.
The Supreme Court of the United States today unanimously struck down a Massachusetts law that had banned protests near abortion clinics. The law had created 35-foot buffer zones around abortion clinic entrances. It was passed back in 2007 after years of harassment and violence at abortion clinics in Massachusetts, including a shooting rampage at two facilities in 1994. It was challenged on First Amendment grounds by abortion opponents who said all they wanted was quiet conversations about alternatives to the procedure with women entering clinics. Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. wrote a narrow majority opinion saying the state could pursue other alternatives. He was joined by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen G. Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan. Justice Antonin Scalia concurred with the majority, but with more strident language, saying that the law was unconstitutional root and branch. He was joined by Justices Anthony M. Kennedy and Clarence Thomas. Justice Samuel A. Alito Jr. filed a separate concurrence. The 2007 law at issue, called McCullen v. Coakley, number 12-1168, had barred everyone from entering or staying in a fixed buffer zone around entrances to reproductive health care facilities.
And the Supreme Court today slapped President Obama by cutting the president's power to issue recess appointments during brief breaks in the Senate's schedule. The court ruled unanimously that President Obama's 2012 appointments to the National Labor Relations Board during a short break in the Senate's work had violated the Constitution. At the time, the Senate chamber convened every 3 days in short sessions when no business was conducted. Those breaks were too short, Justice Stephen Breyer wrote in a majority opinion, joined by the court's four more liberal members. Justice Breyer added that recess appointments are still allowed if they're made during a break of 10 or more days. Many experts say that if either house of Congress is controlled by the party opposed to the president, lawmakers can block such appointments by requiring pro forma sessions every 3 days. Each house must get the approval of the other chamber for recesses of more than 3 days.
And now the latest in worker-related news from our friends at Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
It's very important that all the unions get together and we deliver a strong message to the legislature to let them know how important it is to pass a balanced, responsible budget.
The New Jersey Education Association's Brian Voltz. New Jersey unions vow to continue their legal battle to get pensions properly funded as Democrats in the state legislature try to add revenue for public pensions to the state budget. On Wednesday, New Jersey Superior Court Judge Mary C. Jacobson ruled that Governor Chris Christie can legally cut payments to the state pensions by about $900 billion this year, but the judge let the union's legal challenge to Christie's planned pension payment cuts next year stand. After the ruling, Communications Workers of America New Jersey Director Hetty Rosenstein told reporters the unions will keep fighting the legal battle for worker pensions.
Hundreds of thousands of people in New Jersey, and not only active employees, people who are already retired, like my 90-year-old mother, are dependent upon this pension.
Democrats in the New Jersey legislature are moving to raise additional revenue to pay for the pension payments, including a 15% one-year surcharge on the business tax. Rosenstein says that Christie's own budget policies, including corporate tax cuts, contributed to budget pressures that he says led to the cut in this year's pension payments.
He doesn't increase taxes on the wealthy. In fact, he cuts taxes for the wealthy, but he's increased taxes already on poor and working class people by eliminating your income tax credit, by eliminating the urban enterprise zones for taxes, by cutting homestead rebates, and by increasing tolls and fees on working class people.
The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled President Obama's recess appointments unconstitutional Thursday. Obama made the appointments, including positions on the National Labor Relations Board, after Senate Republicans blocked them. Obama argued that the appointments were made during Senate recesses. Republicans, though, used parliamentary tactics to gavel the Senate into session, even though senators weren't actually there conducting floor business. The Senate eventually approved the nominees after Democrats changed the rules to effectively end filibusters on presidential appointments. Three United Nations experts say tens of thousands of water service cutoffs in Detroit violate international human rights standards. The experts say that, quote, disconnection of water services because of failure to pay due to lack of means constitutes a violation of the human right to water and other international human rights. With high poverty and high unemployment in Detroit, water bills are increasingly unaffordable. As many as 30,000 households are expected to have water service disconnected over the next few months.
Diversified Media Enterprises is now building quality mobile apps customized for your organization, and all purchases help sustain Workers Independent News. More information online at laborradio.org/shop.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
U.S. Senate Republicans took to the floor this morning, renewing their call for a special prosecutor to investigate claims the IRS unfairly targeted right-wing political groups for scrutiny. Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon opposed the proposal, saying that the results of a congressional investigation by the Finance Committee is about to be released. Wyden is followed by Texas Senator Ted Cruz in this clip.
There is nothing of value that a special prosecutor would bring to the table, and it certainly would involve significant costs to American taxpayers. In fact, many of us can remember special prosecutors abusing their power, spending millions of dollars of taxpayer money, and going on for years and years without concluding their investigations. Too often, special prosecutors have turned into a lawyer's full employment program. They ought to be reserved when there is evidence of criminal wrongdoing inside the government. It would be premature to appoint a special prosecutor with the bipartisan Finance Committee report almost finished. And I'll just close, Madam President, by saying I'm a pretty bipartisan fella. In fact, sometimes get a fair amount of criticism for being too bipartisan. I want it understood this is a bipartisan inquiry that is being done by the book. Senator Hatch and I are looking at these matters together. We talk about it frequently. Those witnesses were interviewed together. We brought Mr. Koskinen in immediately. And my view is that it would be premature to appoint a special prosecutor with the bipartisan Finance Committee report almost finished. If we look at this in terms of what is at issue now, we can bring the facts to light with our own investigators and our own bipartisan inquiry and avoid some of the special prosecutor disasters of the past. I object to the senator's request.
Objection is heard.
Madam President.
Senator from Texas.
Madam President, I thank my friend from Oregon for his impassioned comments. I would note for the record a few things that he did not say. My friend from Oregon chose not to say a word about the fact that Lois Lerner, a senior IRS official, has twice pleaded the fifth in front of the House of Representatives. To that, he had not a single response. My friend from Oregon chose to say not a word to the fact that the IRS singled out Senator Chuck Grassley for special scrutiny.
That was Senator Ted Cruz from Texas speaking today in the U.S. Senate. Although Senator Grassley claimed he was targeted by the IRS, recent information has shown one of his own staffers was the source of a leak that led to the investigation. House staffer Brian Sutter, a former aide to Grassley, spoke with a lobbyist about policy changes. If the allegations are borne out, Grassley's former aide violated the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act, forbidding government officials from disclosing non-public information that could affect stock prices.
Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler is warning all health insurers doing business in the state of Washington to end discrimination in health insurance based on gender identity and related medical conditions. In a letter sent to health insurers yesterday, Kreidler said exclusions and denials of coverage on the basis of gender identity are against the Washington Law Against Discrimination and the Federal Affordable Care Act. This makes Washington the seventh state to issue a guidance letter or a regulation clarifying that health insurers in their state cannot discriminate based on gender identity. If a health insurer covers medically necessary services for its enrollees, it cannot deny those services for a transgender person solely on the basis of that person's gender status. Health insurers are required to cover procedures that are part of a gender transition process if they're covered for other policyholders for different reasons. That includes hormone therapy, counseling services, gender transition process, mastectomy, breast augmentation, and reconstruction. Currently, some insurers have exclusions for all transgender services. Today's announcement makes it clear that disparate access to these and other medical services is not allowed. The companies Boeing, Amazon, Microsoft, Nordstrom, and the City of Seattle have already taken action to prevent discrimination against transgender employees in their health coverage. Kreidler said that transgender people are entitled to the same access to health care as everyone else. Anyone who believes they've been unfairly denied medical services by their health insurer should file a complaint with the insurance commissioner's office or call the consumer hotline. The number is 1-800-562-6900. And in the state of Colorado, marijuana retailers all passed a sting operation by law enforcement that tested whether the stores would sell marijuana to minors. The police sent young people who claimed to be under 21 into the stores to try to buy cannabis. None of them succeeded in purchasing it. All 20 stores demanded state-issued identification to verify that customers who purchase marijuana are at least 21 years old. This will soon be an issue in Washington state when retail shops licensed to sell marijuana open their doors in July. In Colorado, the state began issuing retail licenses soon after the law passed in last November's election. But Washington has taken longer to implement retail sales guidelines. Individuals are able to grow their own plants indoors, but until now, marijuana has not been available from retailers in Washington state. Even when businesses do begin selling marijuana next month, they are limited to a very small pool of licensed suppliers. They will also likely be subject to secret shopper-type tests, just like the one carried out in Colorado.
And in international news, President Obama today asked Congress for $500 million to train and equip what he called, quote, appropriately vetted, unquote, members of the Syrian opposition. The move is the biggest push yet by the United States in the Syrian conflict, which has now crossed into Iraq, where rebels are threatening the American-backed government. The request comes as the administration is scrambling to justify its surprise announcement last month of a $5 billion counterterrorism fund for further operations in the Middle East.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Thursday, June 26, 2014. Israeli troops leave an old woman dead near Hebron and continue to attack West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian medical sources have reported that an elderly woman died of a heart attack after dozens of soldiers invaded her home and ransacked it in Al-Arub refugee camp in southern West Bank. Several injuries and arrests have been reported during the ongoing invasion in Hebron. The sources said that Fatima Ismail Rushdie, 70 years of age, suffered a heart attack after dozens of soldiers stormed her home in Al-Arub refugee camp north of Hebron and ransacked it, causing excessive property damage. She was moved to a local hospital in a critical condition and died later on. Troops kidnapped 5 residents during their attack targeting Al-Arub refugee camp. 4 more Palestinians were kidnapped in the West Bank. Israeli soldiers invaded Husan town west of the West Bank city of Bethlehem and kidnapped 1 Palestinian. 2 more civilians were kidnapped in Awarta near Nablus and 1 in Azzoun near Kalkilia in northern West Bank. Moreover, dozens of Israeli soldiers and police officers invaded various Palestinian neighborhoods in occupied East Jerusalem and clashed with dozens of local youth, causing dozens of injuries. An elderly man was kidnapped in Al-Aqsa Mosque as well. With the old woman's death today, the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli troops since June 13 has reached 8. The Israeli army escalation started when 3 Israeli settlers living in an illegal settlement near the southern West Bank city of Hebron went missing. In other news, Gaza's only power plant is still running today after fuel was permitted to enter the Gaza Strip via Israel, just a day after the power authorities warned that the plant would shut down. Additionally, 20 truckloads of medical supplies are soon to arrive in the besieged coastal enclave. On Wednesday, an agreement was reached that would allow the importation of 250,000 liters of synthetic diesel to Gaza's power generator station, according to Fathi al-Sheikh Khalil, deputy head of the energy authorities in Gaza. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, June 26, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, at least 70 Taliban militants have been killed and around 100 injured during ongoing clashes in the southern Helmand province. It's estimated that around 800 militants are participating in the Helmand offensive, which has also claimed the lives of 15 Afghan police officers and injured seven. Around 2,000 families were forced to flee the area. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, has taken control of the border crossings on the borders of Jordan and Syria and is approaching the Haditha Dam on the Euphrates River, Iraq's second largest. The Iraqi army has reportedly ordered the dam's employees to remain inside and be prepared to open the floodgates, which would cause harm to both the National Army and ISIL, not to mention towns and agricultural land in the area.
An ongoing investigation of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl by the U.S. Army has found no evidence of misconduct by the soldier during his five-year imprisonment by the Taliban. Bergdahl was released last month in exchange for five Taliban prisoners who were being held at Guantanamo Bay. His release prompted a backlash from conservative media and politicians who accused President Barack Obama of negotiating with terrorists and questioned Bergdahl's motives in light of his disillusionment with the war in Afghanistan just prior to his capture in 2009. Some have gone as far as calling Bergdahl an enemy of the United States and a Taliban sympathizer. Those assertions are based primarily on an email exchange between Bergdahl and his parents prior to his capture, in which he expressed disgust with the U.S. military culture and its actions in Afghanistan. However, the Army investigation has found no evidence that he collaborated with his captors. Bergdahl has stated that life in captivity was, quote, often difficult, and that he was beaten, he was tortured, he was kept in a cage for part of the time. The investigation has yet to determine whether or not Bergdahl deserted his post prior to his capture.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is myself, Lisa Loving, Terry Eaton, and Paul Rowland. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Jenka Soderberg. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joe Uris guest hosts Positively Revolting Talk Radio. He looks at the current state of Portland City government, and your calls will be welcomed. At 9 on One Land, Many Voices, we hear speakers Phyllis Bennis and Josh Rubner from the recent Sabeel conference on Seeds of Justice and Hope for Palestinians and Israelis. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, we hear Oregon Community Media, produced in cooperation with independent community radio stations throughout the state. The topic will be genetically modified foods. A big thanks goes out to all of you KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not yet a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. At this time, we have a community announcement. Military veterans and their allies will hold a picket line and news conference opposing the renewed United States military intervention in Iraq tomorrow, Friday, June 27th, from 11 a.m. to noon at Portland's Federal Building, which is located at Southwest 3rd and Madison. The event is organized by Veterans for Peace, Chapter 72. The message is no more war and no more dead and wounded.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Tonight's KBOO In Depth features Ariel Derangere, an organizer of the Tar Sands Healing Walk in Fort McMurray, Alberta, Canada. This weekend, the Keepers of the Athabasca Watershed Society and their allies host the 5th annual Tar Sands Healing Walk, an 8-hour tour of the massive development sites of big oil giants Syncrude and Suncor. Derangere was interviewed by KBOO's Paul Rowland about the Healing Walk.
I'm one of the organizers for the Healing Walk, and I'm the communications coordinator with the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation.
So tell us about this. I understand this is the 5th and final Athabasca Region Healing Walk?
Yes, it is.
And so have you been involved in the previous ones?
Yeah, I've been involved since the beginning of the Healing Walk. So I'm one of sort of, there's a sort of group of original founders of the Healing Walk, and I'm one of those.
And what's the purpose of it?
The purpose of the walk, it was really born out of a desire to hold some sort of action in the Fort McMurray region. You know, lots of environmental groups wanted to see like protests or rallies, demonstrations, but the community members from the Fort McMurray region, Fort McMurray proper, and the surrounding First Nations really didn't feel like a demonstration or a protest fit. And they called for a more cultural and spiritual gathering that focused on bringing people together to talk about the problems that they're facing, because, you know, it's really difficult for people to want to participate in a protest or a rally, because I don't think there's a single person in Fort McMurray whose uncle, cousin, brother, sister, mother, father, grandfather, or they themselves or husband or wife doesn't work in this industry. Based on that, they wanted to host an event that was more welcoming and that was led with the foundations of spiritual and cultural grounding foundations. And so the walk was born, this idea to bring people together to walk and witness the tar sands firsthand and see for themselves.
But I imagine people who live up there can hardly avoid seeing the tar sands devastation.
You know, even for the people that live there, where the tar sands are located, it's not like you usually walk in that region. Unless you work on site, you don't actually even get to experience it. So it's really interesting because people have stated that they've driven past it, they've flown over it, they see it all the time, but there was something different about walking with the intent of coming together and witness and calling for the healing of the land. The tagline of the walk is stop the destruction, start the healing. And, you know, walking through that region with that intent really changed things for a lot of people. You know, people talked about how it's just so different and it's so visceral. Like even for myself, I've, you know, had driven and flown over and gone past that region many, many, many times. But the first year that we had that walk, coming around that sort of first corner where you can see the tailings and the wet tailings and the dry tailings and the big refinery, it was something completely new and different. And it was really, like, it really sort of hit the core of you. And it's incredibly visceral, like the smell, you could taste it in your mouth, you could see it, you could feel it on your skin. And even sort of that emotional impact that it had was far different than seeing it on a daily basis.
So this is called the fifth and final healing walk. And I was looking on the website as to the reasons why that is. Maybe you could just explain why this is the final year for this.
This is the final walk in the Athabasca region, but it's actually the beginning of something new. So we're ending the walk here as one big event in the Fort McMurray region, because tarzans exist in other parts of the province and either other parts of the world. And we're encouraging people to host their own healing walks and bring attention to some of the impacts and development that's being done in other regions. So, you know, there's some indication that there may be a walk in the Cold Lake, Beaver Lake region, or the Lubicon region, which is in the Peace River region, next year, where they're seeing a lot of expansion of in situ development. And, you know, in situ comes with its own set of problems and is directly attached to the oil sands development. And we don't want to disclude those types of projects and development and the impacts that those communities are feeling. And we think that people need to start coming up and hosting their own walks and beginning their own dialogues in their own regions to start talking about these issues. And we really want to start focusing on building, you know, community relations and cross sort of border, not border, but cross boundaries, because, you know, the tar sands are separated into three regions, Athabasca, Cold Lake, and Peace River, and sort of strengthening the partnerships between the nations.
And of course, there's in the United States, there's both shale oil and tar sands developments have been going on. Some places have been going on for years and some places just starting up.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's interesting that you say that people up there may not have so much idea, because, I mean, obviously a lot of people in this side of the U.S.-Canada border, a lot of people don't have any idea what's going on. But people who do, you know, tend to see these really dramatic, striking images compared to, you know, Mordor or a moonscape or whatever. People, just these horrific images, photographic images that people might have. But, of course, we don't actually see it directly, or we certainly don't have to live with it like you all do.
Yeah, you know, I think like that's a whole lot of thing is that the people in particularly at the Basque region, we live the Fort McKay First Nation, one of the sites is 9 kilometers from the boundary of the reserve. The proposed Pierre River mine would be 27 kilometers from the boundary of the Poplar Point Reserve. Like, these projects are, you know, open cast mining projects with big trucks running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And the amount of emissions and noxious gases and particulate matter that's sort of released through this processing is quite intensive. And we have communities that are like literally right up against it. And then the impacts of the contamination to the ecosystems and the waterways and ultimately the people. These are things, realities that the people live with every day. We're seeing rising rates of autoimmune diseases, respiratory diseases, and cancers along the downstream communities from the expansion in the Athabasca oil sands region. And these types of things are also increasing in areas in the in-situ regions, where government claims that, you know, these are the more environmentally friendly methods of extraction. But, you know, environmentally friendly, but you look at the Cold Lake region, where the Canadian Natural Resources Limited has been spilling on their site. They have fractured the geological formation through the in-situ process, which is very similar to fracking, where they inject steam into the ground, super pressurized steam, to melt the bitumen and then suck it out through other pipe tubes. It's fractured the geology of the region, making oil spew out from multiple different locations and contaminating an entire ecosystem to the point that they drained an entire lake to try and find a way to stop it, and they don't know how. These are not safe methods. These are not methods that are going to lessen the impacts on communities or the ecosystems that these communities rely on.
And those in situ, the fracking-like methods that they're using are using those huge megalodes equipment that were protested as they went through Oregon and Idaho earlier, I believe.
Yes, absolutely.
So we're all connected. It must just be so overwhelming sometimes. It's just hard to imagine living in that kind of situation. I mean, I was down in southern West Virginia a few years ago, where there's mountaintop removal, And it was just, that was truly overwhelming, just the onslaught, the ongoing onslaught. And I must say, it must be something similar up there.
Yep. You know, there's a lot of comparative similes through the, you know, mountaintop removal and the tar sands development. You know, we don't have mountains, but they're digging huge chunks or huge, you know, open pit mines in the boreal forest and in the marshlands of the Athabasca Delta. This is one of the last remaining fresh inland freshwater deltas in the world. It represents a large portion of Canada's fresh potable water sources, and it's home to numerous species at risk that are classified as species at risk. You know, caribou, bison, migratory birds like whooping cranes. The whooping cranes that winter in the Gulf of Mexico, which has been destroyed by BP's, you know, offshore oil drilling, they summer in the Athabasca Delta, and that is slowly being destroyed through the operations of oil sands expansion and development. And so we have entire species that are being threatened through the expansion of this, and entire peoples and cultures and ways of being that are at risk of being destroyed. You know, my people, the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, are subsistence people. They hunt, fish, and trap. They live off of the land. They collect water from these river systems. And that way of life is being ripped away through the contamination of those ecosystems, through the mismanagement and out-of-control expansion of Alberta's oil sands.
Well, I know it's difficult at such a distance. I mean, people did protest the megalodes, and you know, people are protesting the oil tankers, cars, oil trains coming through here, which are for now carrying the Bakken oil shale oil from the Dakotas, but could easily carry the tar sands oil from Alberta. Also, you know, it's difficult for people to feel they can make a direct impact on these, you know, these huge extraction processes going on in different parts of the world. I mean, but do you have any ideas for people how to give you all good energy, how to contribute to trying to stop that?
I think informing yourselves on the issues that the First Nations people are facing, the private landowners, and just the regular community people in the Fort McMurray, Cold Lake region, and the Peace region are facing. I mean, this isn't just an issue for First Nations. You look in the Peace Delta region, and there are families that have been completely dislocated from where they live because of the development. It's the same thing in the Cold Lake region. Like, we're seeing that this industry will stop at nothing to develop. And they don't even have safety protocols put in place. They don't have reclamation standards that are at a level that they should be at developed. It's about informing yourself. I think, like, we sort of take a lot of things at face value, but I think it's the responsibility of people to find out what's really going on and demand real accountability. What we have in Alberta is an anti-democratic process that's pushing the rights of its of citizens, First Nations and non-First Nations alike, aside so that they can expand and develop this resource at any cost.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your speaking with us, Ariel.
Thank you.
And you are listening to KB.